Hello, and welcome to The Middle. Conversations at the intersection of public relations, journalism, and marketing, where we talk about what's happening behind the scenes to tell and sell stories to audiences in North America and around the world. I'm your host, Sophie Natto, the National Media Lead at Edelman Canada. So, let's get that conversation started.
In a memo to his top executives, Howard Schultz admitted changes have led to a dilution of the experience and a loss of the romance and theater of Starbucks, opening the door to competitors. This must be eradicated.
You'd think the boss would want to talk more. But the truth is, in Canada at least, business leaders are among the most difficult group to convince to do media interviews or other forms of public engagement. Their reluctance isn't helping trust numbers. Our 2017 Trust Barometer data showed that not only are CEOs the least trusted spokespeople to talk business, employees are pacing them by almost double. On this episode of The Middle, the business of being the boss, why business leaders should step up to the plate and talk. I'm joined by two impressive leaders who've decided to take a risk and talk to me today. Derek DeCluitt is an executive editor at the Globe and Mail. He's mainly focused on journalism for the Report on Business section and has more than 13 years at the Globe under his belt. In between stints at the Globe, he spent some time at Rogers Media, supporting content strategy in its publishing division. Lisa Kimmel is my boss. She's also the president and CEO of Edelman Canada. She's leading award-winning work here in the office, but she's also active outside the company, mentoring especially women leaders to get out there and connect. She's the vice chair of the Ted Rogers School of Management Dean's Council at Ryerson University and sits on the board of directors for the Harbourfront Centre in Toronto. Well, thank you to you both for joining me today. This is a tough subject, Lisa, to try and sort of get at the nub of why Canadian business leaders are so afraid to talk. I think we're using the word talk broadly today, but media, thought pieces, writing, events. In your experience, why do Canadian leaders seem so hesitant to step out there?
So it's interesting. Over the last number of years, every time we unveil the results of the Edelman Trust Barometer, before we do it publicly in each of the five cities where we have offices, we do a CEO salon dinner. And I always ask the question of why are you so reticent to put yourself out there to take a stand on a particular topic or issue? And every year I get the same kinds of responses. I don't have time. It's not a priority. I don't have anything to say, which is absolutely ridiculous given the positions that they're in. And so there's just this general malaise and disinterest in doing it, despite the fact that increasingly Canadians, their consumers, their customers, their employees are expecting for them to put themselves out there.
So this has got to be painful, Derek, on the newsroom side of things. If Lisa's getting this in the back room, what does it feel like on the front lines?
Sure. At times it's really painful to get them to come out and say anything that isn't sort of totally bland or boilerplate. And it's not true that they have nothing to say. If you take them out for lunch or get them in off the record, they've always got things to say, and usually quite interesting ones. But and I think there's a few things at play. One is the risk reward calculation for them is a little different than it used to be. Mm-hmm. So their words, if they misspeak, live forever on the internet. They get amplified on Twitter and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And I think job security may be a little bit at the root of the insecurity of about talking publicly, because CEOs don't last as long as they used to, and it is a little bit easier for them to step out of line with their boards, perhaps, than it used to be when things were things were cozier. So I think it's a bunch of things. But then you add, if you're talking about why don't they speak about sort of public policy issues or sort of contemporary political issues, you kind of have to add populism into the mix. Mm-hmm. I think there were plenty of CEOs who, if you could get them off the record, would express to you a pretty unfavorable view of the way Doug Ford dealt with the Hydro One situation, booting out the board, right, getting rid of a perfectly qualified CEO who appeared to be doing a perfectly decent job. But try to get one to say that publicly means, you know, in the era of politicians like Trump and Ford, you know, means you're potentially putting your own neck out there. Look at what Jeff Bezos has gone through as a result, not of what he's done at Amazon, but as a result of the fact that he bought the Washington Post. Then the Washington Post has been kind of negative on Trump.
Right.
Next thing you know, you've got Trump talking about raising postal fees on Amazon. You know, these are not normal times, and the risks are probably higher. And I say that with some reticence because I don't want to discourage them from speaking out. But
you're not doing a great job here. Yeah.
But I think those are some of the factors that go into the thought process. Lisa speaks with them more directly than I do about
right.
it. But
trust is low, right, Lisa, in CEOs in Canada?
Yeah, and in fact, the trust levels in Canadian CEOs is even lower than other markets where we actually survey and ask the question specifically around a spokesperson for a company and what kind of spokespeople that you trust. And, you know, we've tried to talk about, you know, I think about, is there a specific Canadian CEO who's doing a great job of this? I get asked that question all the time, and I actually have difficulty coming up with a single person. Mm-hmm. You are seeing a number of CEOs in the U.S. taking stands on issues, particularly in light of the political situation in the U.S. right now. But in Canada, you just don't see that. And there are topics that are less contentious that they can speak about, and yet there still is a reticence. I think, too, that certainly within our client mix, we work with a lot of Canadian CEOs of global companies. And because of the fact that they're not in their positions for a long period of time, because they're going to move on to their next posting globally, that they also think, well, I'm not going to be here for that long, so why would I put my own personal reputation at risk potentially? Mm-hmm. So I think that also plays into what we're seeing in Canada.
I mean, Derek, you've made quite an argument about why maybe they shouldn't speak. I mean, populism, I think, is probably the most dangerous one right now. But what's the danger of CEOs and other C-suite leaders staying silent?
I think there are a number of dangers, but I guess the first thing I would say is to not engage in the debate. It's not the definition of leadership, and they are in the spots that they're in because they've been deemed to be leaders, and that has to go beyond just the narrow purview of, you know, a leader to you know, my employees. You know, it's got to be bigger than that, especially for you know, kind of larger companies that play a, you know, much bigger and broader role in Canadian society and in the economy. And you will see, you know, I don't want to paint it as entirely one-sided. I mean, you will see people like Victor Dodig of CIBC and others making, you know, passionate and well-argued cases for certain things they want to see on economic development or economic policy, or getting the oil moving out of Alberta. You know, things that are, you know, pretty fundamental to what is economic growth going to look like in Canada over the next little while. But those are sort of safer ground issues. I mean, nobody's going to criticize a bank CEO for saying, you know, we need to have policies that supercharge, you know, growth and help employment and
create, to argue
create
that.
Better
although he is an example of someone who has been very vocal around women and championing gender diversity in the workplace. And so you have to applaud him for taking a stand on that particular issue.
That's right.
But can I ask you, okay, so Derek, if you're a CEO and, for example, the Globe and Mail is coming to investigate something about your company or investigating an area of business that you happen to be a leader in, so what are the pros and cons in your mind of a CEO participating in that journalistic process? Because it's one thing to say, okay, CEOs, go out there, do thought leadership, go out there, do speeches, go out there and tell people what you think. But more and more CEOs are also hesitant to even participate in a journalistic process of sort of fact-checking and getting at the details of how the business community works. So give me a sense of like what both sides of that equation looks like as you're working on a story, for instance.
I mean, there are no cons to speaking with us. I would say that honestly. And yes, it's my job to say that, but also you're going to get a much more complete and much fairer story if you join us and sit down and talk to us. you know, we, you know, yes, part of our job is to, you know, be a watchdog on behalf of the public and investors and so on. And sometimes that's going to lead to critical coverage. But at the same time, you know, it's the Globe, and we're committed to giving everybody a fair shake and a fair say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we spend a lot of time training our journalists and talking to them about, you know, if we are doing something investigative, about the right of reply, and making sure that when we go to companies where we've got perhaps an unfavorable set of allegations or a complaint or something like that, that we're specific about the details of, you know, what we're looking into and why, and that we give them sort of adequate amount of time to respond, bearing in mind that, you know, we are also a news organization and we work at a pretty rapid cycle, but and emphasizing those principles with our reporters over and over again, you know, you must give them a fair opportunity to comment, and you must be specific about what you want. And all of those things, I've seen it over and over again, where you look at the draft of the story before the company responds, the company finally responds, and I can tell you, you know, the story almost every time comes out more favorably to the company when they do participate.
Well, one of the things that I always say to clients is that, you know, the cocktail party is happening, whether you decide to join or not. So media outlets are going to do their stories. And wouldn't you rather be a participant at the cocktail party so that then your point of view is actually a part of that story?
Though, Lisa, I guess it would be fair to say, too, not all newsrooms share the excellence of the Globe and Mail. There's a lot of cutbacks and resourcing issues in news, and it's creating an environment where the journalism isn't always top-notch. And then you add to that, you know, Trump's whole thing on fake news and seeding these seeds of doubt in the news media. I mean, what would you say to a CEO who's concerned that, in fact, they'd be feeding themselves to the wolves?
So I think that, you know, there is that that CEOs, communications advisors, their communications teams can determine which outlets they want to speak to, and what channels they want to use. And it's not that because they've been asked to do an interview with a particular outlet, if it's not a credible or reputable one, don't have to participate.
Yeah.
But to your point, with one like the Globe and Mail, you absolutely should be part of that story. And so I also think that there is a role for communications departments and communications consultants and agencies to help in educating and bringing executives along so that they can be comfortable participating in interviews and stories.
Let's talk about an example that the three of us actually ended up working on together in a way, the Me Too movement. I vividly remember, Lisa, last year before Christmas, sitting in a hotel room in New York on the phone with you, talking about you wanting to talk about the Me Too movement, you wanting to sort of get out there and express your views on it, and the stress that I had about the, oh my God, are you sure you really want to do that? Can you talk a little bit about that process? And also maybe, Derek, you can tell us how the Globe waded in on the Me Too and how things have evolved in terms of executive
sure.
leadership,
so
from
I,
your example?
Yeah, so I go back to Derek's comment before around leadership and what defines a great leader. And part of being a great leader is having courage. And so there was lots of discussion around the Me Too movement. And one of the things that I kept hearing from male executives was, I don't feel comfortable being with female colleagues as a result of this. Mm. And that means that, you know, for all of the good of the Me Too movement, actually there are potential negative consequences for women, and it could lead to a step backwards for women if their male colleagues aren't wanting to interact. The other reality is that, you know, executive suites across Canada are still dominated by men. So if they're shutting out women, women are never going to get ahead. And so I felt really strongly that I hadn't heard anyone talk about this particular consequence of the Me Too movement, and therefore felt an obligation to actually raise it as an issue.
There was a lot of push, though, and I'm sure, Derek, on your end of things, too, like that issue from top to bottom has been a delicate one in terms of editorial choices.
Absolutely. You know, one of the consequences of of the Weinstein story and everything that came from it was names would come forward, and in some cases, we investigated what went on and wrote stories about it. In other cases, we took our best shot at it and could not corroborate sort of what we'd heard, and mm-hmm. and those are stories that that never saw the light of day, mm-hmm. or perhaps they will someday, but they haven't yet. Mm-hmm. And it is a delicate issue, and I think it is it's also wrapped up in the broader issue of inequality between men and women in business and in the workplace, and particularly in senior levels of companies. And although it may be viewed by many as a separate issue from sexual harassment and all of the and more and all the horrible stuff that that has gone on in some of these places, it can't totally be separated, right? Until there's greater equality at the top, I think the issues of power and balance between men and women in the workplace are going to continue, and it will be a shame if one unintended consequence of the Me Too movement is that men are unwilling to mentor women. That really should not, be the case. And really, men should not be afraid to mentor women as long as they're abiding by the rules of how they do it.
Yeah, but are you finding, though, like men willing to sort of leap into opinion copy or be more vocal about a way forward? I mean, I just anecdotally outside of this conversation, I've talked to other women about, where are all the guys? Like, how come they're not saying more? And I'm just curious if you have any insight on that.
Why they aren't saying more about...
Just about where we're headed and changes that could happen. Or if you're noticing a trend in terms of a willingness, we're talking about CEO willingness to talk about difficult issues.
Right. Well, I think we said off the top that, in Canada at least, it's quite difficult to get CEOs to weigh in on debates generally, even on safe ground. And then when you talk about issues that are as sort of hypersensitive as the Me Too movement, I don't have a lineup of male executives at the door wanting to write about that for the pages of the Globe.
One of the interesting things that happened with me was when both of my op-eds were published in the Globe and Mail, I did have so many male executives say to me, "Thank you so much for raising this particular issue that is of concern to us." They sent me texts, they said it to me personally, they called me, emails, and my request to them was retweet, share my post. Not a single male executive did that. Because again, there is, I believe, a lack of comfort in talking about such a sensitive issue.
Well, why do you think they were unwilling to retweet?
Because I think that what they probably felt was that they might be criticized for past behavior, to your point, that maybe they have done something in their past and they don't want to be called out for it by bringing attention to themselves by talking about a particularly sensitive issue, particularly amongst women. And so I don't know. I mean, it's a mystery to me.
I think it may even go beyond just if they have something in their past. It may simply be a fear that something is going on or has happened in their company that they don't know about, and a mere act of retweeting could set them up for accusations of hypocrisy.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, but then what I would say is that then, to your point around the importance of gender equity in the workplace, if they have an issue in their company, a good leader will address it head on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's my view.
It's so interesting. I think part of the sort of underlying fear here, and we've witnessed this on social media, is, and I hate to use this word because Donald Trump has been using it lately, but the fear of the mob, right? The fear of like this righteous anger that can bubble up through social wildly, irrationally in a way that can tear down other people, right? And so sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly, most of the time messy. A lot of our trust data is showing, for instance, that the most trusted spokesperson right now is the employee, right? So we're seeing a lot of business coverage, just to shift a little bit here, but a lot of business coverage focused in on the employee experience and or the customer experience, to the point where they've become the most trusted spokespeople and the CEOs are on the other side. So you're seeing, for instance, I think of stories of employees who are complaining about their employer in a, you know, on a certain way they're being asked to do sales practices. Or I'm thinking of customers who have been left off of flights or have been left out of a customer experience that they thought they would be able to enjoy. I'm just curious, do you think that that imbalance in trust has created an environment where it's even more difficult for CEOs to wade in because they actually can't beat an upset employee in the news? They can't beat an upset customer in the news.
I mean, my view is that this just demonstrates the magnitude of the problem. And so CEOs absolutely need to step up. They need to demonstrate what are the values that are important to them personally and also organizationally, corporately. And so in order to build trust, they need to be engaging in these conversations both internally and using external platforms to share their point of view.
I mean, Derek, how do you feel about this? Because, I mean, I, not to call it CBC, but I will call it CBC. I mean, a lot of the clickbait stuff that we are seeing now is single source employee or customer experience stories, right? Which then drag a company into a conversation about a certain thing. And not to say that that's not reasonable journalism, but as we discuss sort of the comfort of a C-suite leader on these issues, I mean, what do you have to say about some of the trends on this front?
Yeah, I mean, the way that CBC does some of that stuff does create dilemmas for us because, you know, it's not that we want to ignore a legitimate story about customer service issues or employees feeling undue pressure. And that being said, you know, in a telecommunications company of 25,000 people or a bank of 50,000 people, you are inevitably going to get employees who are unhappy or feel unduly pressed to sell things in their job and or other situations. So I don't want to dismiss the CBC or their approach. It's different. It's different from our approach, and we would take those stories and, yeah, we would try to look through them and see and assess, okay, how serious is this? Is this one or two complaints at a huge company, or is there something potentially more systemic? Does this ring true for other things we've heard about that company? Mm-hmm. And then we will sort of choose to pursue it on our own or not, depending on how we assess it. Your question about focus on the employee, or, you know, focus on the customer experience, to me, a lot of it stems back to if you take the narrative of business over the past 20 years, the 90s was sort of an era of the star CEO, the celebrity CEO. Mm-hmm. Then you had a market crash. Then you had a recovery from that. Then you had the financial crisis. Mm-hmm. So in the collective memory of everybody who's sort of over 35, you've had two really disruptive, and with the financial crisis in particular, really seismic periods that caused a broader loss of faith, or contributed to a broader loss of faith in senior executives. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know,
you're saying populism, yes.
There's populism going on, not just in how we view politicians, but also how we view corporations and in journalism.
Yes.
Sure.
Though our trust data shows that business is actually the most trusted institution in Canada. And I think in the absence of trust in politicians, there actually is an opening for business leaders in this country to step up.
Yeah, but will they feel like they get a fair hearing, I guess, is my point. Because the business model of journalism has shifted so much that newsrooms do have to consider pull through on their stories. I mean, you guys use data on the back end, Derek. I mean, you, and I'm sure you use it to make editorial decisions, right? So, I mean, are we, because populism is such a fierce sort of driver in our industry right now, can CEOs really count on a fair hearing, I guess, is my question. Beyond your newsroom, I guess.
I mean, they can from us. I can't speak to other newsrooms, but I think what you're talking about, in a way, is traffic and the way that the media business model has, for some companies, has moved towards what's the way we can get the maximum number of eyeballs as fast as we possibly can, and that's clearly sort of the CBC digital model. Mm-hmm. And they have a view of it. You know, our view of it is that we're going to build a much more sustainable long-run business by, you know, being a trusted institution that, you know, several hundred thousand Canadians hopefully will pay us every month to get the journalism. And that in order to sustain that, we have to, you know, we have to make sure that we're seen as, you know, fair and credible and not chasing clickbait.
Yeah. I mean, 54% of Canadians, or at least to start interrupting you, but disengage from the news. So do CEOs have other options?
Well, and that's exactly what I was just going to say. Amazing. Business executives can be thinking about what's the right channel to tell what story or to share what point of view. So it could be media, but it also could be using their social channels. And again, not that many Canadian CEOs are actively engaged in social media. But there are a variety of different channels that they can be using and should be using.
What level of confidence do you gauge from CEOs that you work with around social media specifically?
I think that there's a reticence to do it because they think that it's so time consuming. Hmm. Well, the reality is that it doesn't have to be. Hmm. And, you know, you can be strategic in determining, A, what are the topics that you actually want to be speaking on or about, and then determining the frequency of that engagement, and also being opportunistic around things that are happening in the news that make sense for you to comment on or not, or what information or news you want to share or not.
Are there any in Canada that you see doing social media really well, as like as senior level people?
One example that does come to mind is Peter Aceto. He is someone who, you know, who engaged in social media right at its infancy and has, I think, a very large following at this point in time. But there aren't that many, to be honest.
Mm. It's partly an age thing there, potentially, right? Is the demographic of your average CEO in Canada does not perfectly overlap with the sort of digital native native generation.
Right, but that said, if they have a young workforce, and if their customers are young too, they need to figure out ways by which they can connect with whoever is their target audience.
Everybody with a cell phone now is kind of a journalist, is what we're often saying here at Edelman with our clients. And, you know, employee relations are media relations if you know, because of this pipeline into clickable stories and you know, news organizations that have basically intake valves where if you have a grudge on your employer, you can just write in and say, hey, let's talk about this, right? Does the newsroom sort of wait and watch some of the social media behavior on the part of businesses, or how does it fit into your evaluation of if a CEO is in a company's interesting, or do you guys even take a look at that? Or
sorry, I'm not sure I understand.
So if for instance, like Lisa's on Twitter every day, does any of that have any impact on how you evaluate a CEO's sort of readiness or availability to speak on issues? Does it help grow their influence with your newsroom in any way? Or
I think it's very useful. Because anytime executives are putting themselves out there, then that gives us a sense of sort of what's interesting to them, where is their head at, what are the kinds of things that we might be able to engage them on to pull them in to talk to us.
Right.
But you know, there's not a lot of it I'd say we've spent more time on the business side watching Trump's Twitter feed and then reacting to it in terms of what he's saying about, you know, this automaker or that, you know, whatever his sort of corporate enemy of the day is, than we do sort of following the more mundane social media entries of various Canadian CEOs.
The intention here is to encourage more people. You can't describe it as mundane.
I'm just saying some of them, they're not necessarily that good at it.
If there was a CEO out there just tweeting about baseball, you'd be totally into it. Let's be fair.
I would watch.
Right.
I would watch.
See, so there you go. Yeah. So before we wrap things up, I do want to get at the Trump factor. Because it's true, he can shape the news cycle. If you tweet in the wrong direction related to the president at this point, you could be, you know, exposing yourself to undue risk, especially given all the latest things on trade. Lisa, what's your evaluation of the impact Trump has had on this environment? I mean, we are seeing a lot of values-based decision-making happening in companies in the U.S. Do you think some of that will come this way? And how should CEOs behave in this Trump-esque environment?
Well, I think in the U.S., things are completely different here, right? So I think that in the U.S. there is, and I know this based on you know, discussions that I've had with U.S. colleagues who are advising CEOs in the U.S. that initially there was complete panic if they were going to show up in one of his tweets. And I think that at this point in time, there's less and less fear of that because the news cycle is so fast on all of these things. So if he criticizes a company, you know, it's not even within 24 hours. It's less than that at this point that that's old news. So I think that there is more of an openness that more U.S. leaders are going to continue to start taking stands on issues. And I hope that that's the case here too, where it makes sense. So I think one of the important points to make is that, you know, it's not that CEOs should take a stand on anything. They have to do it within their swim lane. What's appropriate for them personally, and also what is aligned with their company and the company's interests and goals, to then determine what are the right topics to be speaking out on.
Well, what an interesting situation, though, for some of them, because the U.S. is so divided politically, and every poll you see shows that people are digging their trenches deeper and deeper, and which means that, you know, you say the wrong thing, you can have 40% of the population, you know, mm-hmm. beating up on you mm-hmm. really quickly.
Yeah.
And that's I think that's a new feature of just the last few years. I don't think prior to this this president, you had the sense that there was that level of risk, even if politics was fairly polarized. Mm. I just say it's a little different here, but.
But I think there's one example that comes to mind in the U.S. So when Charlottesville happened, Under Armour, Kevin Plank was part of Trump's manufacturing council initially. And Charlottesville happened, and you see on the cover of the New York Times all of these white right-wing nationalists, mm-hmm. And their uniforms are khaki pants, and they're wearing Under Armour golf shirts. Mm. You can be on the right or the wrong side of history, and he made the decision to resign from the Manufacturing Council based on Trump's comments, and yes, that would result, and it did result, in an alienation of, you know, a certain percentage of his customer base, but it was the right thing to do.
Mm. Certain companies are able to exploit it. And look at Nike and Colin Kaepernick.
Totally.
They have played that very well.
Very well.
And good for them.
For sure.
They're giving that guy more say than the National Football League owners are willing to. So.
But they also knew what was important to their target consumer.
Right.
Young, urban, millennial, social purpose driven.
Yep.
Right.
The right thing for them to do.
Right. And well, there's a lot to watch for, certainly. I'm sure that's not the end of it. The next time you're in an elevator with a CEO, what's your pitch to get them talking?
You want to take that first?
This is our business. You got to be able to. So make me want to. Let's hear it.
Honestly, a lot of times with us, it starts with, I guess I'm a believer in the soft sell, but let's have coffee and I want to hear about your business off the record for the first time. Just to, you know, no good journalism happens without some level of trust somewhere between the journalist and somebody else.
Right.
Or some group of people. So, you know, we preach in the newsroom, you know, get out there and know the people in your beat. Take them to lunch. Take them to coffee. They don't all, some of them just don't want to, but you know, some of those CEOs just would rather never engage. But most of the time, if you show an honest, good faith willingness to understand what a CEO truly understand, what he's up against and what are the decisions that keep him or her up at night and so on, you can develop some sort of trust and understanding that may later lead to an on-the-record comment. So that's how I would start.
Okay, we'll be setting up those coffees for you very shortly, yes.
So I would say you have a point of view. The expectations of your employees, of your customers, of all of your stakeholders is to share your point of view, determine what are the appropriate channels, and get your message out.
That works. I like it. But she's my boss, Derek. It's true. So
get the message
I'm more
out.
Direct.
In the Globe. right? You forgot the last three
words. For sure. Oh, right. Right.
Listen, this has been such an interesting podcast. We could keep going on. I'm sure there'll be more discussions in the future. So thank you both for the time today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to continue the conversation, find us on Twitter. Derek is at DeCluet, Lisa is at Lisa Kimmel, and I'm at Sophie Netto.